Greetings and salutations. Welcome to this evening's April 2009 edition of Science News Update. I'm your host, Jim Campanella. This month, I'll be delving into several recent science news stories having to do with food and food supplements. I figured, since I had disrupted everyone's sleep for the last 2 months, why not mess with their diets as well? I'm kidding, really. Just kidding. Seriously, as a parent, I worry about what my kids eat and the food supply. Here in the U.S., over the last several months, we've had a series of scares with contaminated foods. The two latest were peanuts a couple of months ago, and pistachio nuts in the last couple of weeks. And just to put our minds at ease, we were told by the Food and Drug Administration here in the States that the pistachios have probably been contaminated for the last couple of years. Yippee. Now I know where my stomach cramps came from last month after some pistachio ice cream. Blah. Anyway, we are all very concerned about what we eat and whether it is good for us and our children or not. And several stories about those very subjects brought themselves to my attention in the last couple of weeks. I hate being a purveyor of doom and gloom, but unfortunately, it simply turns out that way sometimes. And truthfully, I'm just as often surprised by some of this news as I'm sure that you are. Let's start with the topic of milk, a subject that is near and dear to my heart. I love milk, and yogurt, and cheese, and ice cream, and just about any dairy product that you can name, even the weird ones like kefir and lassi. I'm happy that I am not lactose intolerant, because that would bring on serious sadness in my life. My young daughter and loving wife are also milk addicts, and I suspect that my 11-month-old, who will start drinking milk in a month or so, will also fall into that category. Milk is good for you, if you are not lactose intolerant, that is. That is a given. It has lots of vitamins and proteins and calcium. It is generally healthy. My pistachio ice cream carton, blech, even had a label on it that said that dairy products in weekly moderate quantities will help you to fend off bone loss in old age. Since I do worry about my own health and that of my family, I generally just buy organic milk. That is pretty much the only organic product that I do buy, by the way. I don't wish to expose my kids to undue amounts of antibiotics or hormones found in most grocery store milk. Well, you can imagine my horror when I read a science article by Timothy Veenstra and his associates from the National Cancer Institute in the Journal of Chromatography that suggested that milk was really potentially quite dangerous. Veenstra's group examined the endogenous hormones that are present in grocery store milk. Endogenous in this case means the hormones that are made by the cow herself. Essentially, they found an ungodly cocktail of steroid hormones that could cause serious problems for heavy milk drinkers. Typically, steroid hormones are produced in the body for use in the body. They tell genes when to turn on and off, but externally derived hormones add noise to this system. This is why hormones from your milk are such a bad thing. The scientists did the work originally to determine the levels of bovine estrogens that are present in milk. Estrogens are female mammalian hormones. The problem with estrogens is that they can fuel the growth of many tumors, even the prostate. And estrogen can do this at amazingly tiny concentrations. Identifying how estrogen's prevalence varies by milk type and what chemical form the hormones occur required a new assay. And this is what the NCI scientists actually describe in their article. Using their new chromatographic technique, Veenstra and company showed a whole range of bovine estrogens in milk. Whole milk contained the smallest quantity of these estrogens, while skim milk and buttermilk contained the most. In all of these milks, most of the estrogen had undergone a minor chemical modification, rendering it less directly bioavailable and less hormonally active. But that doesn't mean that it is inert and inactive, just less active and less available. These cow estrogens can be converted back to their more effective parent compounds. What's more, Veenstra notes, studies by others have shown that relative to free bioavailable estrogens, these so-called conjugated ones take longer to get from the gut into the blood. But they're still there. Overall, skim milk had the smallest quantities of free estrogens. But just to complicate things, the hormone type that dominated skim milk's profile, 2-hydroxyestrone, is one of the most reactive and potentially risky of all metabolites. By the way, this is important. This may not have been clear, but we are talking about the hormones produced by the cow itself. that has nothing to do with humans or anything that humans do. That means that even organic milk would have these hormones. I was concerned enough about this story that I actually tried to contact Timothy Veenstra by email with some questions of clarification on his findings. However, as of the time of this recording, Veenstra still has not responded to me. I don't know why. Maybe he's on vacation. Maybe he's on tour of talk shows. Maybe he's just busy. Or perhaps he just thinks I'm a parochial dolt not worth responding to. Your guess is as good as mine. One of the most potentially frightening aspects of the milk story is its impact on something called insulin-like growth factor 1. This is a protein which stimulates certain types of cell growth. Many studies have linked high levels of IGF-1 with increased cancer risk. And, ta-da, not only is milk a rich source of this growth factor, but people who drink milk also end up with even more of it in their blood. As I have said on this program so many times, nothing in science is ever simple. And the IGF in milk story is anything but simple. Ordinarily, IGF-1 production is turned on when human growth hormone hits certain tissues. Then, it becomes the growth hormone's agent to locally trigger cell growth. Estrogen cannot trigger cell growth without IGF-1 being present. And if it is present, estrogen can amplify the cell proliferating effects seen with IGF. Veenstra and his team showed that this was possible both in breast tissue and in prostate tissue. In other words, with both IGF and estrogen present in high quantities, you can get a triggering of cellular hypergrowth. This is obviously bad in terms of breast and prostate cancer. You don't want cell growth in those places to be overstimulated. But here's the real kicker from Veenstra. Quote, "There's a lot of interpersonal variability in our natural production of IGF. And even though we are sure that drinking milk will increase your IGF level, milk's contribution will still account for a trivial part of the variation between people," unquote. That means that in the end, genetics trumps milk intake. Wahoo for us milk drinkers! Veenstra points out that people who naturally rank in the top quarter in terms of IGF production and drink no milk will still have higher IGF levels than somebody at the other end of the bell curve who drinks a quart a day. Given this confusing mishmash, what are you supposed to do if you love milk? It's not as if you can go off and have a test done for your IGF levels, just because you love milk at least. Well, here is a quote from the mysterious unreachable Veenstra. Quote, "In the absence of definitive safety data, or the presence of an adverse effect which may be small, you have to decide, is there anything good about milk?" Unquote. He goes on to say that, other than developing children and malnourished adults, people probably don't need milk. He finishes with, quote, "I would never say anything stronger than that." Unquote. Now that I've destroyed all your interest in milk, let me tell you about a story that involves birds and has nothing to do with milk. However, it does involve omega-3 fatty acids. You may remember that omega-3s are one of those types of fish oils that you are always told are good for you. Well, lots of human studies have shown that they are good for you, and now a study of quails suggests other ways that those fishy fats may help humans as well. In the March 2009 issue of the Journal of Experimental Biology, Jean-Michel Weber from the University of Ottawa examines the effect that diets high in omega-3s have on quail. Weber originally became interested in omega-3's effect when he saw so many migrating birds chowing down on mud shrimps as they passed through Canada on their migrations. Mud shrimps have some of the highest levels of healthy fatty acids of any organisms on the earth. In humans, omega-3s reduce the risk of coronary heart disease and alleviate depression, but Weber thought they might have other physiological effects on birds. Weber had watched sandpipers on their migrations eating shrimp for years, and he hypothesized that the intake of the shrimp gave the sandpipers lots of fatty acids needed to increase their aerobic capacity. In short, eating shrimp was like endurance training. Weber wanted to determine if it was possible that the sandpipers could build up their endurance by simply eating. All the evidence seemed to suggest that, but Weber needed to test the miraculous fatty acids' effect on less athletic birds. He chose the dumpy bobwhite quail. His question became, could he boost the couch potato quail's endurance by simply feeding them omega-3 fatty acids? If he could do that, then he might convince himself that the sandpipers were eating the shrimp for exactly that reason. Weber fed three groups of sedentary quails an omega-3 diet of, get this, N3 eicosa pentanoic acid and N3 docosa hexanoic acid, or a 50-50 mixture of the two oils for 6 weeks. Then he checked the quail's pectoral muscles to see if their capacity to consume oxygen to produce energy had improved. Measuring the activity levels of four oxidative enzymes, he found that the enzymes' activity levels had increased by between 58 to 90% of levels normally only seen in migrating birds. Mind you, this is in birds who were just sitting and eating. Weber says that he was astonished by the increase. Even top human endurance athletes only improve their oxidative enzyme activity by 38 to 76% after 7 or 8 weeks of hard endurance training. But the quails did even better without getting off their fat little birdie bottoms. They had got fit by simply ingesting the omega-3 fatty oils. Weber further tried to find out why this happened. He did a series of experiments to determine how the fatty acids were able to change the bird physiology to pump them up without lifting a finger. But he couldn't. He examined the birds for changes in mitochondria, that's the organelle that powers the cell, and changes in oxidation enzyme levels. Those are the enzymes that are used in respiration to help make and use energy. And the weird thing is that he could not find evidence of changes in either of those places in the formerly fat quails. Weber's big conclusion is that he knows that it is a real effect and that he can document it, but he has yet to be able to come up with a mechanism for it. Does this birdie effect have anything to do with humans? Probably not. Avian physiology is different from mammalian physiology. We are just different enough in the evolutionary tree so that we are not quite affected in the same way by the same nutrients. It is possible that omega-3s can increase endurance in humans, but first, no one has ever tested for that. And second, omega-3s have been heavily tested for years and no one has ever reported such an observation. You would think that sedentary people, like me, all over the world who regularly take omega-3 supplements in their diets, might have noted an increase in their stamina, if it was indeed the case, but I don't believe that it is, and I don't believe anybody has ever reported that. Well, onwards and upwards to our next story. I think any Brits in our audience, including you, Tony, may find this next story kind of interesting. I don't know if black tea consumption has changed much in the last 20 years in Great Britain, but I do know that it was among the world's top levels for classic black tea drinking for decades. An interesting question that has arisen of late is whether black tea is just as good for you as the highly touted green tea may be. And a recent study from Dr. Verena Stangl's laboratory of the University of Berlin in the journal Basic Research in Cardiology examines that exact question. Is black tea as good for your heart as green tea? First, what is the difference between green tea and black tea? Well, first of all, there are four major types of tea most commonly found in the market. Black tea, oolong, green, and white. Despite the fact that they sound like they are from different sources, all of these teas can be made from the same bushes. They are simply processed differently. The exception is white tea, which is made from the same bush but grown differently. The tea's type is determined by processing, as I said. Tea leaves soon begin to wilt and oxidize if they're not dried quickly after picking. The leaves turn progressively darker as the chlorophyll in the leaves breaks down and tannins are released. This process of allowing the leaves to darken as they dry is called enzymatic oxidation. The next step in the processing is to stop the oxidation process at a predetermined stage by heating, which deactivates the enzymes responsible. With black tea, this is done simultaneously while drying. Black tea is wilted, sometimes crushed, and fully oxidized, which gives it its black color. Green tea, on the other hand, is allowed to wilt, but it is not allowed to go through the oxidation process during drying, and those enzymes are deactivated very early. The upshot is that chemically, black and green tea do differ because of these contrasts in processing. For thousands of years in Asia, consumption of green tea has been purported to have major medical benefits. And today, there is strong evidence suggesting regular green tea drinkers may have a lower chance of heart disease and developing certain types of cancer. So is black tea just as good as green tea at lowering your chances of heart disease? Stangl's group was interested in black tea because there had been so many studies showing how beneficial green tea was in long-term human studies. Although there is evidence for this with black tea, similar epidemiological studies had never been very successful. Since 75% of the tea actually consumed worldwide is black tea, they decided this was an important question to re-examine. Stangl's group compared the effects of green and black tea on nitric oxide, NO, production and vasodilation, and elucidated the tea compounds involved. First, what is nitric oxide? Well, in 1998, the Nobel Prize in Medicine was awarded to Robert Fugat, Louis Ignaro, and Farid Mourad. This was for their discovery that NO is a major signaling molecule of the circulatory system. They found that nitric oxide is a short-lived gas that acts as a signaling molecule. NO is the first animal gaseous hormone that we've known about. Gas hormones have been known for years in plants. The NO is able to relax muscle cells exposed to it, especially cardiac cells. It's actually the basis of the activity of the drug nitroglycerin in relaxing heart muscles. The nitro actually gets converted to NO, which then does the relaxation. So Stangl's group used highly fermented black tea and determined concentrations of individual tea compounds in both green and black tea of the same type. This was Assam tea. The major result is that both teas stimulated nitric oxide synthetase activity as well as vasorelaxation in aortas. This result surprised the researchers. They had expected that the black tea would not have the same effect because it lacked an important chemical the green tea possesses. These are chemicals called catechins. These catechins are compounds in green tea that directly stimulate NO production. Black tea doesn't have them, and yet it was still able to stimulate NO production. And again, just to add a layer of complexity here, in green tea, the catechin compounds are converted to two other compounds called theaflavins and theorubigins. These are actually what stimulates the NO. It turns out that black tea already has theaflavins present without any conversion, and these showed an even higher potency in NO production and vasorelaxation than green tea did. The black tea also already contained theorubigins, which seemed to be highly efficient stimulators of vasodilation and, again, NO production all by themselves. So what is the learning moment here? Well, it seems to be that black tea is equally potent as green tea in promoting beneficial endothelial effects. The theaflavins and the theorubigins predominantly found in black tea counterbalance the lack of catechins there. This seems to suggest that despite claims of green tea being so mystical and fantastical and healthful beyond anything drunk in the West, black tea consumption is probably just as good at preventing cardiovascular diseases. It may not be quite as fashionable to drink black tea, but it seems to have just as many benefits. So the black tea preferences of Great Britain have been vindicated. From a personal standpoint, I don't have to feel guilty about choosing Earl Grey or Irish breakfast tea over matcha green tea anymore. That's all for me. Thanks for listening. As always, take care, and I hope I have inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.